You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode of The Art of Imperfect Adulting, I am excited to introduce you to Melissa Cancel. We're going to talk about vision and we're going to talk about sight. And I think you're very much going to enjoy this story. So I record these introductions right after I do the interviews. That way I have the thoughts from my experience of the conversation. And each conversation is a short piece, a short story, a singular event, a choice, a change from the life of my guest. Sometimes that's more obvious than others. What's fresh in my mind after this conversation on the theme of adulting and imperfect adulting is that this is the story of a person who has a story. Like we all have a story. Just because you don't know somebody's story doesn't mean they don't have one. And yet, when I zoom out and it becomes very apparent in this, that her life overall is, of course, actually much more than any single story. Isn't that always the case? All right, let's do this. Melissa Cancel, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Thank you, Amy. I'm glad to be here with you.
I'm so happy too. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am.
Me too. All right. So I am looking forward to getting to know you more today. You and I have connected very briefly before, so it's not our very first conversation, but I don't know you very well. In the small bit of information that you gave me, I actually learned that you have already led a very full life. And when I interview people on the show, I love to talk about choices and decisions and changes and opportunities that have impacted the path of their life. You actually submitted three, and you submitted vision loss, a relationship story, and a job change. And I thought that while we could talk about any of these things, the one that spoke out to me is the story about your vision, because I think that probably has a broad impact on tons of things. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
All right. This is probably a story that you, I mean, you lived it and probably, I'm going to guess you talk about it a lot.
It depends, more so when I meet new people. But yes, I was diagnosed with a rare genetically inherited eye disease. It's not curable. When I was 10, I had what I would say was relatively normal vision, probably a little nearsighted prior to that. But we used to have eye tests every year in school. And that year I failed both of them. And that sent us to this process of trying to figure out what was going on. I had to go to three specialists before they were finally able to identify the disease. It's called Stargardt's disease. It's a form of macular degeneration, but it happens when you're young. At the time, it was very rare. I've come to learn recently that it's being diagnosed more. I don't know if it's just more broadly diagnosed now, but currently it's about 1% of the population has the disease. So it's still fairly rare. And as I said, there's no cure. And so at the time, the doctors said, well, she'll never be able to drive. She won't be able to be in normal classroom. She won't be able to write on paper. She won't be able to match colors. And so that was very discouraging for my parents. For me, I don't really remember thinking that it was that traumatic. My actual vision loss, I didn't really notice. I know that sounds strange, but as if it happens gradually, which it did over a period of a year before it stabilized, you don't tend to notice slight changes. Your brain just adapts. And that's what happened with me. So my parents, as I said, were very, very upset by this, and especially the idea that nothing could be done about it. So my mom took me to a health chiropractor person that she knew. And back then, the chiropractors were common, but a lot of the unique and innovative kinds of treatments we see now weren't as popular. But this particular chiropractor put me on a very strict diet. So I couldn't have any bread or milk or pork or sugar or salt or caffeine. So that made an interesting diet. Now, again, food allergies are really common now, but back then there weren't a lot of options. I remember having to eat millet bread which was
Okay.
very dry and tasted awful. There's all kinds of options available now if you want to go gluten-free, but back then there wasn't. And we did radio wave treatment on my eyes and acupuncture on my ears. And the worst thing was there was this herbal eye wash that you put in a little cup and you'd open your eye and it was supposed to help heal scar tissue, which is what I have on the back of my retina, but it had cayenne pepper in it.
Oh my goodness, ouch.
Yeah. So if you can imagine that it burned, I did not enjoy that. And so we did it for about a year and it was quite a bit of expense for my parents and we would have to go 3 times a week after school. It was about an hour drive, an hour or two there, an hour back. So big time commitment too. And after about a year, I asked my mom if we could just accept it and live with it rather than continuing doing that. And so that's what we decided to do. And so it meant some adjustments. I had to sit in the front of the class in all of my classrooms. And back then, I actually could see the board as long as I was sitting in the front. I can't do that anymore now. Otherwise, I have a really good memory. So I would say that between my parents adapting to help me, my mom has always said that her mission became to clear paths for me. So
Okay.
just to clear everything she could out of the way so that I could accomplish whatever I desired to do. And my dad was very helpful in that as well. But my memory would be the second big thing that really helped me. I've always had a good memory, but the fact that I could listen to lectures, et cetera, in school and pretty much retain a lot of it enabled me to not struggle as much as I might have otherwise. I now use adaptive computer software, but back then that wasn't available. So I had some very strong magnifying glasses I would use, but it still took me a very long time to read anything that was normally printed. Eventually I got to the point where I couldn't do that anymore, not because my vision was getting worse, but like normal people, when they get to be about 40, their muscles start to weaken and they need reading glasses. It's not so much a change in vision. Well, that was happening to me earlier because my muscles were focusing around the blurred center of vision I had. And so basically they were working overtime. So
Okay.
eventually I got to the point I couldn't read books anymore. I would either get recorded books or my mom would read to me. We did something really special when I got my doctorate. So I have an undergrad degree in psychology, I have a master's degree in communication, and then a PhD in communication. And
So
when I got my PhD,
you really like being able to function in school became was, I mean, you were obviously able to do it. Like, that's something you loved and you needed to be able to do it. I mean,
yes.
you're taking us through the story very, very detailed. I'm going to redirect you and pause, like, to walk people through
Okay.
it. Which is, sorry. So you said you've got, it's a form of macular degeneration that hits people when they're younger. Stargardt's disease, is that how you say it? Okay.
Yes,
And when you,
it's spelled Stargardts.
okay, Stargardt's. And you were 10, and one of the things that I was going to ask was it like, because I did not know what the story was it a singular event or was it something progressive? It's a little bit of both. The trigger was that it sounds like a classroom exam that you say in school where they would just show you the eye test and have you read the thing. And that was the
Well,
first
that's when
thing.
we found out that there was something wrong. The
Something
trigger
wrong.
was genetic, that
Yeah.
something happened between my
So,
4th and 5th grade years.
between 4th and 5th grade, do you know anybody else in your family that has any other sort of so genetic, but you don't have any idea where you had no idea this
It's
was coming?
definitely genetic, but what the doctors say is it could have been 200 years ago and they just knew they couldn't see well. They didn't know that they had this specific disease.
Well, and that's one of the you started on this, but this is one of the questions I had, like the change and how this happens over time with technology and how we do things. So you did that. I was, can you explain? So you describe yourself as being legally blind. Like obviously you and I are engaging on a visual platform or on Zoom. Can you share with the audience a little bit about what that means, the legally blind
Sure.
versus like what other people may not understand about it?
So legally blind is a technical definition, which basically means your vision is bad enough you can't drive.
Oh, just driving. That's the only thing they care about.
Yes, it is a number. I believe it's 20 over 400 is the line of legal blindness. I could be wrong on that, but It basically, normally we say a vision is 20/20. That's normal vision. Mine is something like 20/800 now, which means what you could see 800 feet away, I could only see 20 feet away.
Wow. Okay. That is, you know what? That is an amazingly efficient way to describe that's the 800 feet. I did not know that that's what those numbers meant. So I appreciate you sharing that. So I was thinking about this, and you talked a little bit about this, about the way it was a slow progression. I was trying to remember for myself how much of my life and my experience I might remember before I was 10 years old. And I have flashes and little pieces of things, but I don't really feel like I remember tons and tons of things. I have a lot of stories that people told me about when I was younger. But the question that came to mind is like, do you have a sense of a before and after when, before you got this diagnosis with how you saw before or not?
Not visually, as far as my visual memory, and because of the adaptations that my parents and I were able to make, I don't really know that I can even say school-wise I noticed a big difference. I did always love reading books. When I was in first grade, I read 100 books as part of a reading challenge. So I loved reading books, and that was something that was became very challenging for me afterwards. We started getting large print books at the library
Okay.
so I could still read. But because it was so difficult, I didn't do as much reading. And it pretty much became that all the reading I did was all what I had to do, not reading for pleasure. So that
Okay.
was definitely a big change. But other than that, I think my body and my mind just naturally adapted. And being so young, it wasn't as traumatic, I think, as if I had been older.
Yeah. No, and you were, yeah, because you were able to adapt and move forward. I know somebody who went through a version of this when they were in their mid-20s. And so, and they found it in a job exam. They were training for a job that required an eye exam, and that's when they discovered it. So it was a pretty dramatic life shift because of when the time of discovery in a different form. This, when I talk to people about changes and decisions, right, they can fall into two kind of categories: changes we make for ourselves, and then things that we do because of things that are outside of our control. And obviously, you did not wake up like one day I woke up and was like, I think I'll get LASIK. You did not wake up one day and say, you know what I'd like is I'd like Stargardt's disease. And so when I want to talk about, and you were talking very generously about this already, about the support that was around, and the people that supported you. You were a kid, and it sounds like your parents were willing to pave the earth to do research and try all of the things. You talked about some of the modifications. You moved to the front of the classroom to be able to see the board. You have modified the books and the way you consume written content for sure. What do you remember any other modifications as a kid and some of the things you do? And then we'll move into talking about some of the things you do today and how technology has shifted that.
As a kid, other than the reading issue, that was probably the biggest thing for me. I never did end up having a problem matching colors. I could still write on paper. So the reading was a big thing. And the driving didn't really hit me until I got older, to the point that I should have been able to start driving and I couldn't. So those were the biggest modifications as a child, just being able to adapt to school and reading. And so I have a blurred center of vision where we have 180 degrees in each eye, and probably a good three quarters of that is a big blurry spot in the middle of my vision. So only my periphery is clear in each eye. But as I mentioned, my brain and my eye muscles worked around it, so I didn't see that blurry spot when I was younger. I actually didn't start seeing it until I became about 30.
Really?
And
Okay. That's
yeah.
interesting.
And so while it still impacted, because it's a retinal issue, it still impacted that I couldn't read normally. I didn't actually see blur. So I could still make normal eye contact with people. And I didn't generally have any kind of a problem with running into things or falling or anything like that. Once the blur became visible to me, then those started coming into play. So now I have a very hard time making eye contact. My camera is at the top of the screen. I have a large screen that I'm looking at, but I'm having to look almost to the bottom of the screen to make it look like I'm looking at the camera.
I do not have any visual modification. I'm constantly looking at the wrong place in every single Zoom meeting I do, in every single selfie I take. I'm always looking in the wrong place. So
Yes. So
I
the same thing,
commiserate with you.
I take pictures and I'll say, okay, does it look like I'm looking at the camera? And usually I have to look down at like the person's, chest in order for it to look like I'm looking at the camera. And so that's disconcerting. It used to be people really couldn't tell that I had the disease unless they saw me read.
Okay.
But now it's a little more visible in the way I make eye contact that something's off and not quite the way it should be. Kids are great, especially because kids will start looking above their head like this to try to see what I'm looking at, because I tend to look
Okay.
above the blur. And so then I have to tell them, I'm looking at you. It doesn't look like I'm looking at you, and I know that, but I am.
That's
It's okay.
out of the mouths of babes, for
Yes.
sure, for sure.
Yes,
So
exactly.
when it comes to technology, you and I might be roughly the same age. I'm not entirely sure. I'm 51. When I was thinking about how some of the things might have changed since you were 10 to today, and how we consume information. When I was in my 20s, actually, I did volunteer work for a Lighthouse for the Blind, Miami Lighthouse for the Blind. I would go in and read the newspaper. And I actually looked it up as I was getting ready for this because they don't even do that anymore. And I think it has to do with the fact that it's not actually needed because there's more technology that will read print for
Correct.
people. And the proliferation of, that's the word I mean, proliferation, it's so easy, so easily available to find audio books and resources on audio and things like that. But I was thinking about what are some of the, because there are probably a bazillion ways that this impacts you that I would never think of because it's not happening to me in my daily life. What are some of the things that you are aware of that have changed since you were 10 to make modifications easier for you to function in our high-tech world?
Well, I'm very close in age to you. I'm 53.
Oh, so
So,
okay, there you go.
yeah. So we had no computers. There
Right.
was very little technology. So my mom reading for me basically did what you did at the Lighthouse for the Blind. Now, when I did get into my college and graduate work, I was able to get textbooks read on cassette, an 8-track cassette player, from a place called Recordings for the Blind. These were people who volunteered like you.
Yeah.
And so while I appreciated their service, it was challenging to listen to them read. So a lot of times with that 8-track, I would speed it up so that I could listen to the content faster and keep paying attention to it. And then we progressed to computers being available all through high school and even college. My mom typed work for me, so I didn't have to
Okay.
worry about typing. But when I decided to do my master's, I decided to move away from home and go to Purdue University in Lafayette, Indiana, and I was going to be on my own for the first time. So the Division of Blind Services there purchased me a computer, but I needed to learn how to type. And I will tell you, the first paper I had to do on my own may have been, I don't know, 5 typed pages. It took me forever to
I
try to
bet.
type that paper.
What years were those?
When I was that year was probably, let's see, 90, 93, 94,
So
that
that's
area.
when, because when, because now the software will talk to you and tell you, read you the menus and things
Yes.
like that. But that's not super old, that technology and the first rounds of
Yeah,
it.
back then it didn't do that.
Yeah.
And now I did have some software I could scan documents into the computer and those would read to me. But the screen enlargement software was nothing like it is now. So I did have something available, but it's much better now than what it used to be. Now I have a software that will enlarge my entire screen and I can navigate around the screen, or I can choose for it only to enlarge a certain window. When that kind of software first came out, it would only enlarge within a certain frame window. And then you had to try to move your mouse on the rest of the screen and get what you wanted in that enlarged section so you could read what it was. So it was very time consuming.
So let me ask you a
Nice,
question,
but
because I do think so. You did make a decision to pursue a very, very academic course of study where this was going to be a challenge, a continual challenge. Was there ever a time that you can remember, even for a flash, thinking, you know what, maybe I should look at something where I'm not butting my head up against this wall every single day?
I probably considered that all the time. I think that the reality probably hit me most, like I said, when I moved away from home because then my parents weren't nearby to help me. I had to take a bus, a public transportation bus, back and forth from where I lived to the university. And I know lots of people do that, so that's not a big deal. But I had numerous issues happen where I had to get off the bus and transfer to a different bus, and I would get on the wrong bus by mistake and then have to take another route to get back. Or I'm standing out on the side of the road in snow, hoping nobody's going to slide off the road and hit me, but I can't stand too far back because I need to make sure I wave down the bus when it comes and I can't see the bus, very far away. So And then typing the papers for myself, having to try to do research for myself. Now, I could ask people for help, and I did. But back then, computers were available, but they weren't nearly what they are now. When I would go to do research, I had to go and look up everything on the computer and then find the journal articles in the stacks and copy them all, and then take them all home and try to read them, which
Yeah,
was
research was a
challenging.
completely different thing in the 90s. This is several years ago, but I was trying to explain to one of the youth in my family what microfiche was and looking things up when I did not do a particularly good job of explaining this to them, but they did not understand because everything is so easily accessible now. It is a completely different is a completely different kind of way. And you did say, I mean, I'm trying to envision the challenges. One of the reasons I ask about support, like really the reason I ask about support, is to give people a chance to express, things that they are thankful for, but also to give awareness and a chance to talk about the support that's really helpful to have around, because we don't know what other people need unless somebody gives us a chance. And I'm trying to envision, it must have really been scary to be navigating public transport away from home as an adult, and being uncertain about those things. The closest thing that I've probably come is being in a place where I don't understand what the signs say. So I'm in a place where I can't read and I'm not sure if I'm, and that's scary. It's really, really scary.
And I've had numerous things happen where somebody I knew was going to pick me up from Purdue, for example, and the car pulled up into the right location, looked like the right car, and I got into the car only to realize I was getting into the wrong car. Thankfully, that wasn't a situation where it was dangerous, but definitely embarrassing. So I've had that happen on multiple occasions where I see the wrong thing, I get in the wrong vehicle. I even had it happen. I want to say I was 30, and we had gone on a family vacation to the beach in St. Pete, and we had gone to a mall I wasn't familiar with, and I can walk around fine. So I had left my family and walked to a different store. Well, I thought it was close to close time, and I had told them to meet me at the store. I didn't hear or whatever, and so they come in. So the store was closed down, and we didn't have cell phones. I didn't know what to do. I wasn't going to be able. Park lot until we could locate the vehicle that I came in. And by then, my family had already left and were outside trying to figure out what to do. So we were able to reconnect. But I kind of jokingly said, how embarrassing is it to get lost from your family when you're 30? That's something that have kids, not a 30-year-old adult. But it happened to me.
And
So.
you know what? I think that that's yeah. I think that's a good story to share because it can definitely happen. I mean, we think about that as being a kid's thing, but it definitely is something to be aware of. So before we had this conversation, I did a little bit of Googling about visual impairment and visual correction. And according to the nice folks at Warby Parker, which they just have that eyeglass store, so I don't know how reliable this data is, they say that 66% of the people in the world have vision correction. So like me wearing like readers, or I had LASIK earlier, right? I think that it's interesting. So that means that the majority of people who are listening to this, the majority of people on the planet, they're aware of and the reality of like needing a little bit of correction to feel, to see a little bit better. Very few people probably have a daily interaction. You said 1% of the population have what you have, but really, truly, very few people in the population have daily contact with people who have a significant visual impairment. And like you were saying, there are all these situations in your daily life where it's not actually set up for you to be able to thrive. You're adapting and you're living in a world without the adaptation. I wanted to give you a chance to share some of the things that are helpful or even unhelpful as you go through your day.
So there are things I just wish they would make general rules. Like if they always put the ladies' restroom on the right-hand side, I
Oh,
would love that.
what a fun, that is a very good one, because every time I see like
They
the,
look different. Sometimes I have to walk right up to the door to be able to tell what the sign is, and then a man opens the door and I'm standing, right there. So that's one thing. The other thing I really wish that they would make standard are the debit or credit card machines at grocery stores. If they made them all the same, I would be able to memorize what to do, but because they're all different, I always have challenges with those. Now with the cards that tap, it's a little easier, but when you used to have to insert your card all the time and do pins and all of that, those were typically the times where people would comment. And it's interesting, as you say, because most people can relate to the idea of having a visual impairment and it gets corrected, or people who are completely blind and they expect them to have a ring. But this area in between is very people. And so what the assumption was I typically got was that I was too blind to wear glasses. So I'm trying to use the machine, and the register would say, "Oh, glasses at home or what? You too?" I've actually had people say, "What, you too proud of glasses?" I'm like, no, I have a rare incurable eye disease by glasses.
Aye, that's
I
it.
actually, one time when I was on a plane, something with my, I have strong, because they're so strong, I have to hold it really close to my, and the person asked me if I was smelling paper.
Wow.
I was like, okay. There are a lot of those daily things. I would say in general, most people are helpful. And this is something I actually teach when I commune, that when it comes to a person who has a disability, you should never assume they want you to help. For example, I wouldn't want someone to walk up to me and grab a paper that I was struggling reading and read it for me. But to ask is always a good thing. Do you need help with that? And that's what happens most of the time. If I, I'm struggling, the cashier will say, "Oh, here, let me help. Is it okay if I help you with that?" And I'll say, "Yeah, or I'll just say, "I'm visually impaired. I can't read it. Can you push the right button for me?" or something of that sort. And in general, people are very, very willing to adapt, even if they don't really understand the reason behind it. So those examples I gave earlier, I mentioned those only because you will find that. You'll find people who will stigmatize you, treat you oddly because you're not doing what appears to be normal, and there's no obvious explanation for it. Nobody would question me doing that if I had a cane or a dog, but because I don't, it's confusing. But in general, I just ask for help when I need it. And sometimes it means I go, I say, "Hey, I need to find this in the grocery store," and somebody will take me to find it. And there's a lot of things that you can now, especially with technology that's available on our cell phones. If I'm in a field, let's say, for example, but I'm wanting to find their product, I can get myself to the right area and then use my cell phone and find the screen and find what I'm trying to find. I will say, though, most of the time, since I can order groceries online, I do that instead because that's far easier for me than going to the store and having to find the items myself.
And
So
that's an
the technology
example.
as it's progressed, has made a
That's
huge.
an the grocery store, I hadn't thought of that. I also hadn't thought of the standardization of the bathrooms. The standardization of the card readers in stores, I think that everybody should do that because that is, I have no impairments, but it would be so helpful if they all followed the same routine because about if I go to three stores a day and do three different transactions, at least once a day, they have to be like, hey, you have to push the button or you have to put your email in or whatever. And it would just make life so much easier. That should be a rule. 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 I've always thought about every time I see the braille on the outside of a bathroom door, I always to myself think, this seems to me like a wonderful idea that's not as practical as people think it is, that you would walk up to a wall and just be feeling around to try and figure out where you were. I think that that is not as
Where
helpful
the sign
as
is and where the braille is.
right, exactly.
I have a
Assuming
funny
and
story. I was in a Walmart that I wasn't familiar with, and I was headed to the bathroom, and I see a man heading to the bathroom in front of me. So I'm thinking, okay, he's going to go in one door and I'll go in the other. That solves my problem. I walk into the bathroom and there's urinals, and I'm thinking, what happened? And so I come out and I meet the guy coming out of the ladies' restroom the other way, and he says, I went into the wrong restroom. And I said, I went into the wrong restroom because you went into the wrong restroom. And then we go into the right restrooms. So
that,
yeah, the little tricks you try don't always work.
but that's a very endearing story, and it's wonderful because it worked out for everybody. Okay, so I appreciate you being so giving in telling the story about yourself. We've done a lot of talking about this personal experience, and I do appreciate that because I think it gives people a context for an experience. And the other thing is that I love about this is that you have such a breadth of experience, and you made a choice to go through this advanced education and pursue through that. I want to give you a chance to tell the audience about your business that you're in now, which you call yourself the communications doc. So tell everybody what you do. You gave us a hint with your some of your education that leads up to that. What you do and how people can find you.
Teaching communication. I started teaching college, and so that's what I've been doing for the past 30 years. And recently I decided that I wanted to transition out of the academic world and start my own business, which is the communication doc. And my goal is to help committed couples, the couples who love their spouse, want to stay married, but they struggle. They have a lot of conflict. They struggle with understanding their spouse, with communicating effectively, with maintaining connection, placing a priority on their marriage. A lot of those normal daily issues that we struggle with. I want to help them learn how to communicate effectively, listen effectively, manage conflict, and build and maintain connection. So that's really what my program is. My signature program is a group training and coaching program called Get Communication Healthy in Your Marriage. And the reason why I chose that title, besides the fact that I'm doc because I have a PhD, but I'm also playing off the idea of a physical doctor because we have this idea that of the happily ever after marriage, we see it everywhere in the media, and that's completely unrealistic. We're never going to be happily ever after, but we can be healthy in our marriages, just like our physical bodies. When we're healthy, things can come, we can get sick, but our bodies are better going to be able to recover when they're healthy versus when they're unhealthy. And the same thing happens in our marriages. There are steps that we can do to make our marriages healthy so that when storms, trials, circumstances come into play that we can't control, hit our marriages are able to recover, maybe even get stronger through the experience rather than those things having a devastating effect. And my website is the communication doc, doc.com. And so people can head there and learn more about what I do and contact me if they have more information. I have the opportunity to have a one-on-one call as well, so people can sign up for that as well, and we can discuss more if we're a good fit.
Very cool. So I will put the link to that. And also, you have a master class that you have offered up to the audience. So I'll put that in the show notes. And also, the easiest way to get this information, I think, is to be subscribed to the Imperfect Adulting newsletter subscription, and then you just click on the link, it comes right into your email. So you have a masterclass which is called Overcoming Four Thoughts That Will Destroy Your Marriage, a masterclass and a PDF guide, and that I will give you information of how to access that to everybody there. So this has been fantastic. I think the work you do is really important. I love that you called out the myth of the happily ever after. That's one of my favorite things to point out, that that's not a real thing. Or it's not an instant thing. Let's say it's
And
not an instant
when we
thing.
believe and we look for that and we expect our marriages to be that way and they're not, it can really make you dissatisfied and discontent and disillusioned. So
Yeah,
it's a really
absolutely.
important thing, a myth to break.
I agree. Okay, so now we're going to wrap up with three goofy questions. I call these rapid fire. The idea is that they're just for fun and that you answer in just a couple of words. You and I are alike. Brevity is not necessarily our strength, so we'll do our best.
Got it.
What is your favorite snack food?
Probably, I like tortilla chips and salsa con queso.
Nice. All right, very good. What is a do you have a favorite style or type of music that you like to listen to?
Probably love songs.
Okay, from any particular
Like
decade? All
more like easy listening contemporary type things.
right, very good. All right, so what is something that you think of that reminds you of your childhood home?
Wow, that's a hard question. A wall air conditioner.
Okay. Wow. That is a very clever answer. Why?
Because we only had one air conditioner in the house that was a central unit in our living room, and that was supposed to cool the entire house, which of course it didn't. So that's just something I think of when I think of growing up in that house.
So the outside, the exterior rooms, like the rooms to the outside that weren't in the central area, they all had window units. Yeah. That's still a thing down
No,
here.
we had
Oh, you had
one unit
one wall
in the
unit in the
whole
whole house.
house.
I misunderstood that story. I misunderstood. I thought you had a central unit and then you needed satellite. You had one window unit for the whole house. That is.
No. We had one unit in the wall in the living room. All the other rooms had nothing.
You know, it is interesting to think back to like the 70s and 80s and sort of reflect on how uncomfortable housing was even then. You know, like it was not, we did not have
And the
the.
cars never had air conditioning,
Yep,
right?
no, vinyl
Never had a car
seats.
with air conditioning. And now I think, I get so hot if I'm in a car without air conditioning. And how did I survive
And the
back
other
then?
thing is that all of the so you and I both live in Florida with the canals, and I grew up with roll down windows, so you could roll them down a little bit and roll them up, and you never ever see that anymore. Everything is electric, and you know, so it's and you can't even. I know people who've sent a car into a canal, and so they try and buy like a totally manual car to try and do that, and they can't. It's like they're like, no, doesn't exist. Sorry, not available. So that's it, Melissa. I want to thank you very much for being a wonderful guest on The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.